I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. This is Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF, is better known to Americans as Doctors Without Borders. It's a global, impartial, nonprofit entity that provides medical assistance to victims of conflict, epidemics, and disasters. Many of those individuals are refugees fleeing war zones, or in the case of Central America, refugees fleeing countries that have become like war zones. Jason Cohn is MSF's executive director. He joins us today, as does Samuel Almeida, MSF's regional advocacy manager for Mexico and Central America. Almeida says MSF's main role in global conflicts is to bear witness.
Since the beginning of the organization, we believe that we're in places that other organizations are not, or with vulnerable population, and this comes with the responsibility to make it visible to the world what's happening. We see things no one else sees, so we have to speak about the plight of the population. My role with MSF, I mean, this mandate, MSF mandate of bearing witness, evolved over the 45 years. Today we have a much more structured way of working with this mandate, so my role for the Mexico and Central America mission is to first monitor the situations we see, what are we witnessing, what are the issues we need to make it visible, and then develop and implement an advocacy strategy or how to try to bring a change to the context where we work.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Mexico and Central America. It wasn't too long ago that there was a large population of Mexicans who were going to the United States, particularly to look for work because there wasn't much employment and they needed to provide for their families. And they would go up and work and they would send money back. But it doesn't seem like we're seeing that Mexican population migrating into the United States anymore. We're seeing more of that population coming from Central America. And the reasons they're leaving are a lot more dangerous than the ones that the Mexicans were leaving their country for, correct?
Well, I think it's a combination of factors. Of course, there's a lot of people that are leaving because of violence. I mean, we've seen El Salvador and Honduras, extreme levels of violence, which can be compared to war zones, where we also work. This is a driving factor for the people to leave their homes, right? They can't find safety in their own country, and so they decide to migrate north. Of course, there's also economic reasons, but many times it's not clear because people often normalize the violence in these countries. It becomes part of their day-to-day, so access to economics, to provide for their families, and violence are related, it's not so much clear. But yes, regardless of the reasons why they're going north, Mexico is also not a safe country for them, right? So we work on the route in Mexico until the border is the U.S., and most of our patients experience some kind of violence. This population, these migrants, they are targeted because of their vulnerability. So there's often kidnappings, extortions, physical violence, sexual violence that specifically targeting this population.
And I know, Jason, you've also worked in Mexico as well, working to help these migrants. And there was an article that you had written recently. You had mentioned that there is an area, I can't remember the name of it right now, 72?
Yeah, La 72. It's a shelter in Tenosique, which is in southern Mexico, just really about 40, 50 miles from the Guatemalan-Mexican border. It's one of the so-called albergues that we work in. It's a larger shelter, and we have a medical team that provides sort of a social worker to identify what are some of the ways that the refugees and migrants could provide assistance, because they're afforded some things like access to healthcare in Mexico, and so helps them navigate that kind of system. Obviously, doctors and nurses, and then psychologists, because we see a tremendous amount of mental trauma in the people that are coming. Not only the experiences they had in their home countries, whether it be El Salvador or Honduras, but along the route. As Samuel has noted, about 68% of the people that we see in those clinics have experienced some form of violence, and we're talking about extreme. It's being shot at, beaten, tortured. Most of the women that we care for and we meet in these projects in these shelters that we work in, they often tell us how they initiate birth control because they know they'll probably be raped on the road. And so they take these preemptive actions. The people leave. They have cell phones without any phone numbers in because when they're kidnapped, they don't want their families at home to be extorted. So there are all these coping mechanisms that people put in place. Tenosique happens to be one of the first stops for people oftentimes as they come into Mexico, but they still have about 1,000 miles left to go before they reach the U.S.-Mexico border. So their journey has only begun.
So how do you prepare them for that road ahead? Obviously, not all of them are going to make that 1,000-mile walk or bus ride or train ride. Some of them may stay in Mexico, or some of them may disappear. Some of them may go back home. But you're there, like you said, just a few miles from that Central American border with Mexico. What do you do for those migrants who are going to continue on to ensure that they're going to be in an okay place psychologically and physically?
Well, very practically, when they first arrive in the shelter, part of the intake is explaining to these people that what I just said, which is they've only begun the journey, and we're going to help them to get some physical, mental health care. But we also provide them maps, essentially, where other shelters exist along the route, and also warn them of some of the things that they're going to potentially face. They should have access to some forms of care in Mexico, but oftentimes that doesn't happen. There's a huge effort to deport people, detain them, and deport them back. While they're in Mexico, it's actually a very large and efficient operation that's been going for a long time. It's not just during the current U.S. administration. But what's interesting, I think, really, and what you alluded to earlier, is there's been a really dramatic shift in the migration patterns over the last 15 to 17 years. In the early 2000s, as you noted, predominantly we had Mexicans crossing over into the United States. Now we've sort of, in the last few years, particularly since 2014, really crossed a threshold where we see most of the people coming are from Central America. It's no longer young, strong men coming to find work. These are people who are fleeing from neighborhoods that they are imprisoned in, effectively, in places like San Salvador and Soyapango, a suburb of the capital city in El Salvador. And it's really that kind of pattern that has changed quite drastically in the last 15 years.
And Samuel, if you look at a map, obviously, United States, such a huge country, Mexico, such a huge country, but Central America takes up such a small amount of space on that map, yet there's so much violence within that small region. Where did that violence originate? How was it that that part of the world just became suddenly so violent? Or maybe not suddenly, maybe over a period of time.
Exactly. I think it's never been a stable area. I mean, MSF has been in Honduras for over 40 years now. We're an emergency organization, so we're used to go to a country, have a medical care, and leave shortly after, in a few years. In Honduras, it's not this traditional place. Of course, it hasn't always been the other situations of violence or urban violence. We've been there for the hurricanes, natural disasters, refugees from different countries. The evolution, really, of these organized criminal groups, I mean, I think it accompanied the war on drugs somehow. That's not something that we witnessed directly as MSF. There are many factors to that. But also, women who are fleeing, there are many victims of domestic violence, right? So they don't trust the judicial system in the countries, or the police is not available. They don't have economic resources, and they see no other options than to flee the country.
We are speaking with Samuel Almeida, Regional Advocacy Manager for Mexico and Central America with Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF. Also joining us today is Jason Cohn, MSF's Executive Director. MSF is also known as Doctors Without Borders. When we come back, Almeida and Cohn argue that the vilification of Central American migrants by many in the U.S. is unfounded.
They're not criminals. They're exercising their internationally recognized right to seek asylum based on a well-founded fear and persecution. In this case, extreme violence.
More with Jason Cohn and Samuel Almeida next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Thousands of Central American migrants have fled their homes in the last month, and they continue to flee into Mexico with hopes of finding a semblance of normalcy and safety in Mexico or the U.S. Violence, extortion, and lack of jobs are the main reason people flee from what's called the Northern Triangle, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Those three countries are considered the most violent in the world. Mara Salvatrucha, MS-13, is one of the gangs that has people there living in fear. Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF, has been assisting Central American refugees with medical and mental health services. Samuel Almeida is Regional Advocacy Manager for Mexico and Central America with Doctors Without Borders, MSF. Jason Cohn, MSF's Executive Director, says gangs like MS-13, thought by many to be a Central American or Mexican criminal organization, actually originated in the United States.
Yeah, well, if we go back to the 1980s, just in terms of U.S. government support of different interventions, whether it's in El Salvador, where the U.S. government backed a very strong government against sort of left-wing rebel groups that fomented what, in the end, killed about 75,000 people during the course of that civil war, millions more displaced, fleeing the country, some into other countries, Honduras. We haven't spoken about Nicaragua, but also destabilizing Nicaragua, obviously, with the Contras at that time. And then what you saw is actually in the 90s, under the Clinton administration, changes in some of the immigration laws that allowed essentially deportation for very minor offenses. And what happens is you've seen a huge number of the deportations are actually people who had a serious criminal background. And so you had some of these gangs. We heard a lot of talk about MS-13 as one of the main gangs. It's not the only one in El Salvador. Its roots are actually in Los Angeles. And so, you know, exporting some of that kind of violent gang criminality back into El Salvador over a very long period of time. But some other organizations have really made correlations between those deportations and increases in the murder rates and also the decreases in child school attendance as a result of the sort of criminality that it's been fostering. And when I was in San Salvador back a couple of months ago in April, so we have mobile clinics provide primary health care to people in these different communities. I went to several of them, and what people tell you is that they're essentially trapped. They talk about so-called invisible borders. They can't cross a street. And sometimes that street is where a health clinic is, or it's where their child's school might be. And so they're really trapped. And the parents also are telling me about how they would keep their sons in once they turned 11, 12, 13 years old, just out of fear that they're going to get forcibly conscripted into these gangs. And so it's no way to live. They're subjected to so-called war taxes, extorted. Even those who have viable businesses are often threatened if they can't meet those extortion demands. And that's what we see is a lot of time, even people who had a so-called middle-class lifestyle having to leave because of these threats of violence, even though they had no desire whatsoever to leave their home country.
This current administration has made immigration a big part of its policy. It's put it pretty much in the headlines every day, but every administration prior to this one has also had its own immigration and deportation policy. And one policy change in particular that's taken place just very recently seems almost targeted to people seeking refuge from Central America, and it is the denying of asylum to people who claim domestic abuse and gang violence. I don't know if the people in Central America know or care, because I know that people, they would rather risk death leaving or risk deportation than staying in their home country and face certain death. So do these policies even have an effect?
Just to mention, I think it's important to highlight that these policies, they're against the recommendations of the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, right? And it's their interpretation of the Cartagena Convention that these people have a valid claim for asylum. What we see of people being deported from the U.S. Is that, first of all, they don't have the information they should get about their rights. So when they're kept in detention and many times they're transferred to federal prisons, the government just do it without informing them what's happening to them or what rights they have. So I don't think this is on their choice to make the trip or not. And just we don't have solid data on that, but my perspective talking to the people who are deported is most of them will try the journey again. Most of them say, yes, I'm here for a few weeks and I'll go up north again. And as Jason mentioned, many women ask for contraceptives because they know the risks. Either they have been subject to sexual violence or they know that they could be. and that's how they try to prepare for the trip, but they have no intention to stay in Honduras.
Anyone can present at any point. They can claim for asylum any entry point in the United States. There's been a push to have people go through certain port of entry. Most people do in terms of making that claim. But we also have seen and heard that there are real efforts to prevent people from claiming asylum, even so, you know, directing them back to the Mexican law enforcement who then jail them. And then we get later into a process of deportation. So it speaks to what Sam was saying about lack of access to information about the rights people have. We've also seen this in Mexico as well. And oftentimes people will say, just deport me and they'll take the route again. And it's also important to point out that all these efforts, it doesn't prevent the people from trying to make the journey again. All it does is they pay more to smugglers, they put themselves in greater danger, and they enable an industry of trafficking as a result. So it's really just feeding the beast rather than stopping anything from happening.
So Jason, what do you think needs to be done? If you could fix one thing that could make life better for the people there, what would it be? What does that country need in order to stabilize and to make its population safer?
Well, I think stability, security, economic development, that's a long-term issue, and that is part of some of the U.S. foreign policy. But the problem is less probably about those efforts in terms of the more long-term. It's more the immediate. This, unlike what we see, I think, in a lot of places in the world where there's a kind of an organized humanitarian response, or there attempts to be at least, most of the aid system that exists, let's say, in Mexico, it's really individual faith-based groups, churches, organizations like mine, Doctors Without Borders, International Committee of the Red Cross, but it's not the kind of aid response that we would typically would see, even in a place like Uganda with South Sudanese refugees coming in large numbers in there. So we don't see really, I think, a commensurate humanitarian response. People are also applying for asylum, not just in the United States, but also in Mexico. The Mexican government is also a bit overwhelmed with those applications. They have very few people actually who evaluate each of those individual claims, and so there's a huge backlog. So some of it is just strengthening, I think, the humanitarian and immediate need response. Not detaining people in prisons along with criminals. They're not criminals. They're exercising their internationally recognized right to seek asylum based on a well-founded fear and persecution, in this case, extreme violence. And so they need to be treated accordingly. They're not breaking laws here, and that's a lot of the narrative that is happening, unfortunately. The Mexican government, I think, also can use additional support as well. I mean, we're talking about roughly anywhere from 400,000 to 500,000 people that are moving through this area on an annualized basis. That's not an insignificant number of people. But our area of expertise is more in meeting people's immediate needs. There's major needs for mental health assistance. About 1 in 10 of the people that we care for have signs and symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. That's roughly in the neighborhood of what you would see in a real war zone, an actual active war zone.
So let's sort of take a broader view of the refugee crisis. What we're seeing in Central America is something that the American public has become very familiar with the news every day. But what similarities do you see amongst these Central American refugee seekers, asylum seekers, and the other refugees that MSF cares for around the world? What are some of the key similarities that you find in each and every one of those locations? And I'll ask this of you, Samuel, and then you can chime in, Jason.
Well, I think the pathologies that we see in our patients are very much similar, either here in Central America or in conflict zones. So especially when it comes to mental health, we're talking about anxiety, stress, PTSD. So the impact, the consequences of violence in their physical and mental health are the same than in conflict zones.
I would say that the common thread is that these are people who just want safety for their families. I've seen that in Syrian refugees, in Jordan, in South Sudan, with people fleeing ethnic violence. Every place that I've worked with this organization, I've seen people are simply searching safety for their families, which is a human act and something that we should recognize. You know, these are women and children, young children. I met unaccompanied children as young as 8, 9 years old, you know, bringing their younger siblings with them on the road. I think for those of your listeners who are parents, I think just to put themselves in the shoes of that moment when you're asking your child to go on their own, on the road, into the unknown, and what you must be going through to take that incredible decision. We see that also in the work we're doing in the Mediterranean, in the search and rescue vessels that we've operated up until recently when those boats were prevented from operating. You see lots of young children who've been essentially put on rickety boats into the Mediterranean. So I think the common thread is desperation, seeking for safety, and that is, I think, what we would all hope for our loved ones and our friends is that they can find that. And that is essentially what we see around the world with the 68 million people who have been forced from their homes today, which is the largest number since World War II. And everywhere I've gone, it is the essential and common factor that binds all these people that we're assisting.
We've been speaking with Jason Cohn, Executive Director of Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF. MSF is also known as Doctors Without Borders. Also joining us today was Samuel Almeida, MSF's Regional Advocacy Manager for Mexico and Central America. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Fernando Ortiz Jr. is our editor, and Vince Kong is our digital editor. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.